Rescue attempt?
Might be.
Yes.
That's supposed to be Saturday.
What day is it today?
Wednesday.
Exactly.
Welcome to Film Fight Club. It is indeed Wednesday. I'm Glenn Falkenstein from Falcon Screen.
Is it?
It is. It is Wednesday.
Oh, okay.
I always thought it was Wednesday, unless things have changed dramatically in the last week. We still go by the lunar.
It's Groundhog Day. Hello, Bill Murray. Bill Murray stories.
Every day I'm recording an episode of Film Fight Club.
You know, Michael Shannon was in that movie. Michael Shannon was the young kid at the end who came in like, "You saved my life, Bill Murray, you've changed everything," and felt
really?
The young girl. Yeah.
Wow.
Actually, Michael Shannon has had a great career. He was in Vanilla Sky earlier, which was not his best work, but whatever. And he was in Bad Boys 2, which means he has to be in Bad Boys 3, which is coming out, what, next year?
But why does he have to be in Bad Boys 3?
Because he was also in Bad Boys 2. Yeah, he was the
bigger
dealer.
Question is, why does the Bad Boy 3 need to exist?
Well, because otherwise you wouldn't have Bad Boys 4, which is also coming out.
What?
Yeah, I think they're doing back-to-back sequels. It's so awesome. I've been listening to the soundtrack lately.
So
seriously.
Awesome.
The Nelly soundtrack for Bad Boys 2 is still out of this world.
Look, all the actors who are out of jobs, just stay out of your job because you don't deserve to have one because your time has clearly passed.
Wow. Wow, that's awful. Will Smith is great. And I want Martin Lawrence to be credited first, like in the first Bad Boys. Remember Martin Lawrence is credited above Will Smith?
That would be great. That would be great.
That's probably fair. He's a better actor.
Was Martin more popular than The Fresh Prince?
At the time, because remember you had Blue Streak, you had like a lot of big Martin Lawrence films. I'm trying to remember more of them, but they were big
they were
at
there.
The time. They were popular. And we should introduce the rest of the panel because otherwise we wouldn't be Film Fight Club. We have Chris Evans.
Hey.
Here. And we have Virat Nehru.
Yep. Cheerio.
Who obviously very excited to, you know, as I am, to see Bad Boys 3 come out when it does. Michael Bay's
because
new extravaganza.
I'm such a bad boy.
It's not
right.
Michael Bay. It's directed by some like hotshot European people whose names I can't remember.
But then how are you going to have a low angle 270 degree shot as they stand up? And
maybe we won't.
That's sacrilege.
Times are changing.
You know what's going to happen? John Woo should direct a Bad Boys movie.
It was called Face Off.
Yeah. John Woo would be fantastic. This week on Film Fight Club.
This week on Film Fight Club, we are not talking about John Woo. We are talking about the Cine Latino Film Festival, just screening out PAL Cinemas, and Alfonso Cuarón's Roma, which we have all seen, which will be screening on Netflix next month, just in time for Christmas.
There'll also be some screenings coming up later this weekend, I believe.
Yes, there's one screening at the Verona Cinema on the 24th and one at Norton Street on the 25th before it lands on Netflix on December 14. We'll also be discussing the new Suspiria remake, which is in cinemas now. A lot of contention on that one. And later in the program and on the podcast, we'll be talking about the Japanese Film Festival, which is in full swing at Event Cinemas George Street. I'm heading there in a few days to catch double and pretty keen.
Oh, which double are you doing?
I want to do one we're going to talk about, One Cut of the Dead, because I want to see it with a big audience, and I want to see Killing, which we're also going to be talking about later in the program.
Yep, we'll also be talking about the new film from Masaki Yuasa, the great anime director, Night is Short, Walk on Goal.
Yes! Yes, but first we are talking all things Roma. It is one of the most anticipated films of the year. Certainly it's Oscar season, and this is the one that is going to get and is already getting a lot of buns. It is directed by Alfonso Cuarón, who is also the cinematographer for the film, which is not surprising given how masterfully it is done. It is set in Mexico in the 1970s amidst a massive upheaval, and it is about a middle-class family and a key figure in their life, Cleo, played by Yalitza Aparicio, who is typically plays a figure that goes less acknowledged than they should, but certainly gets a lot of breath in this beautifully, and I can't understate this enough, beautifully shot film.
I think what really makes the film work is building the film around Cleo, who is the maid to this middle-class family. So all of the bourgeois kind of struggles they go through are really grounded by this more humble perspective. And she really is a humble character, but in one in whom Cuarón finds a lot of quiet strength without ever really sentimentalizing her, which I think is the great strength of the approach in this film. It's such a humane film, and the slow kind of burn style that Cuarón's been working towards, I guess, since Y tu mamá también.
Which is also screening on the final night of the Cine Latino Film Festival on November 28th.
Worth checking out if you haven't seen it.
Gael Garcia Bernal was so hot in that movie. Just as an aside, anyway.
But
back to the topic.
Yeah, the immersive long take approach really pays off in this film. It takes its time. When it opens up, it opens with sort of a lot of very quiet domestic scenes with not much happening so that you can get used to this style of long, sweeping, black and white, wide angle shots. But gradually through this approach, it builds empathy. The accumulation of details in Cuarón's direction and in the mise-en-scene is so precise. This film feels so lived in.
I talked about it last week, but I'm going to talk about it again because, well, why not? It's such a beautiful film, and what Chris talked about, and I'm going to agree with Chris again, seem to be doing quite that lot recently. Why
Film Agreements Club.
No, especially with Chris.
We'll probably still snap out of it.
Actually, yeah, I feel like I'm disagreeing more with Glenn more and more. I feel like, I don't know why that's happening.
But we'll wait for Glenn's shocking take on Roma.
I know. No, but actually, what I did love about what Chris mentioned, it's a very humane film, and that's a interesting way to put it because that's a very, probably the most acute description that you can talk about the film in those terms. And one of the things that I love about the film is how, despite people from different backgrounds, different sociocultural identities, what experiences do actually bind them together. For example, Cleo being a maid and, you know, the mistress of the house, and them being women. And by virtue of being women, they're treated somewhat similar ways by men in their lives, and yeah, that binds them together. So despite their actual class differences and their sociopolitical differences and their status differences, they still find that common ground by being women. It's a really interesting way to actually talk about differences and commonality in that sense.
That's a good point, because even though class is a major theme in this film, the movie is never really condescending to upper class or the lower class. It just finds the humanity in people and the way that they go through emotional turmoil no matter where they're coming from.
But it takes time to empathize with the more upper class figure, which is
That's
fine.
True.
Because we get to learn more about them as we get to learn more about the main character in this film. And on this point, I just want to focus on the first incredible 6 minutes of this film, because while we get introduced to the main character, we don't actually see her properly. We don't get a visual of a face that we can recognize and identify with for quite some time, which means as we still see her move about, we are forced to reckon with her environment. We learn more about the environment she's in, which is so crucial to the film before we learn about her. Masterfully done.
She's a figure in this space, which is perfect for the idea of, you know, who this character is. She's the maid. She's meant to just sort of be
in
there
the background.
Be there in the background, do the things she's meant to do, keep this environment looking and feeling great, and that's it.
But she changes from part of the mise-en-scene to actually the main focus very gradually of the first act of the film, early in the first act of the film.
Which I think is mirroring the relationship she has with this family, where over time, real bonds are formed. I think it's interesting to talk about this film a week after we were talking about Shoplifters, because this is another film about being part of a family when you're not, you know, literally tied by blood.
Yeah.
Different kinds of family structures. Because at the end of the film, she's 100% a part of the family.
And yet, Glenn, you had very contrasting reactions to Shoplifters and Roma, I guess. Well, you liked Roma, right? I'm hoping you liked Roma. Otherwise, we have to call off our friendship.
Oh, I did like. I definitely don't want to do that. So I will state unequivocally that I did enjoy Roma. I enjoyed Roma more than Shoplifters. I think the reason is that with Shoplifters, the compelling aspects of the narrative occurred within the third act. Here, it immediately happens within the first act of the film. More importantly, I think we're able to empathize with more of the figures within Roma at an earlier stage. It's about really, I'd say mainly one figure, but I'd say broadly two, whereas Shoplifters, I think, spread itself a little thin by trying to paint very detailed pictures of several characters, whereas I was appreciated being able to simply focus on one character in this film more so.
I disagree on Shoplifters there, but I'm surprised to hear you say that most of the action, the action's happening straight away in Roma, because I found it actually was a bit of a slow burn. I started to really care about the characters and get involved maybe not till 15, 20 minutes in.
Well, in terms of action, interaction started to happen, the moment when we get a little more idea of the world she's enveloped in is a scene we were discussing about off air where she has a interaction with a young man.
And oh, that was incredible. That was the moment where I thought that I'm watching Solid Gold.
And then every scene, there weren't many scenes with this individual, but every scene with him, especially in one long shot, was
really striking.
One pan, just beautifully staged.
Absolutely. He represents, I think, so much turmoil personally and politically, but he is allowed to be just this little side character that drops in and out of the narrative. This is such a beautifully streamlined film. I mean, we're about to talk about Suspiria, and watching that after Roma just makes you appreciate how beautifully Cuarón has streamlined a lot of complex elements and also brought together the political and the personal in a subtle, non-heavy-handed way, where you're able to draw your own parallels and conclusions without Cuarón hammering you over the head with political commentary.
Exactly. Like last week, I mentioned that, and I completely agree, and that's one of my... Because there's so many political films trying to be political at this current time, because
just
everything is...
Everyone wants to be taking a huge stand right now, which is understandable,
but
is it the best approach for art?
You know, winking at Spike Lee, aka Black Klansman, but I am in some sense. But you know, it just feels like you can make a political film, but you don't have to make a statement. And I think a lot of films are not trying to be films, they're trying to be statements at this point in time. But even without that, what I really did like in Roma were the quieter moments, which seemingly do not add anything to the narrative until you realize quite a lot into the movie that they actually were adding something.
This film is really all about the quiet moments. It's
especially,
it's really...
for example, you know, something as banal as dog poo becomes so important.
Or airplanes flying overhead.
Airplanes flying overhead,
hugely significant. Or the opening shot, which we haven't mentioned, which is one of the best establishing shots I've seen in recent memory. In a stationary shot, it builds anticipation like I've very rarely seen. It was stunningly done.
There's some beautiful scenes, there's a couple of great scenes set in the cinema, and one of them, it was a nice little way for Cuarón to acknowledge some inspiration for Gravity, I thought.
Yes. Oh, that was great. That was it was the one self-aware moment in the film, and it could have been a very film that was conscious of itself. It was going back to the political elements of it. We have the three characters who we've discussed representing the upper class, a lower class, and the political turmoil, but it isn't hackneyed. You don't look at them
and think,
here are three pieces in this game. And actually, they work as dramatic persona in and of themselves.
Well, since we were just talking about how quiet and how important the silences are in this film, there's no way, going back to how we introduced this, that this is going to be as big at the Oscars as a lot of people are talking about, I think.
Yeah,
this film,
I think people,
or on Netflix. It's not a Netflix movie.
But it's also, in a way, beautifully, I guess, counterculture to actually be on Netflix, this kind of a movie, and if it ever has a following on Netflix, I would be...
It's a weird kind of quiet revolution happening by
putting it on Netflix.
I think this is a movie that can only exist because... people like, you know, Netflix are searching for prestige right now. Because for such a quiet film, this is a mega production for such a subtle film. Yeah. The scene where all the characters run down a street and we're just taking in these sweeping period detail. This is a big budget production for a really quiet and...
this is not Season of the Devil.
Yeah, a quiet, odd film.
Yeah. Think of, there's a sequence where you're just in a warehouse and it's regular, and then you see literally hundreds, thousands of individuals involved in this huge-scale turmoil. Think of the scene in Dr. Zhivago where they're just in the house, and then the giant sweeping breath of people walking down the street towards the Zhivago's place.
It's staged in a similar way to the attacks early on in Children of Men, I thought. You know, our focus is on a character in the foreground doing something mundane, and then in the background here comes this massive sweep of action.
And this is something we don't talk about. It's sound design, essentially. You know,
the sound design was amazing.
Sound design is exceptional because you can actually feel each and every, you know, frame of the movie and what they're supposed to do. The leaves are rustling, and you can hear the leaves rustling, and yet people can talk over it. The mixing of that, it's fantastic. It's very precise, actually.
There's a scene involving ocean waves at the end.
I think it's the best scene in the film.
I agree. It's very beautiful, but it's just pounding on the soundtrack. Yeah. And the urban landscapes are really intricate soundscapes as well. The mixture of photography and sound here is fantastic. What do we all think of the black and white cinematography?
I seem to be like rediscovering the good things about shooting in black and white, which I kind of miss in color, and the depth of field, especially.
Oh, the depth of field in this film is incredible.
It's just so beautiful because you can have things happening in the background and the foreground, and it doesn't distract you and things can happen in both compositions and you can still be okay and you can focus and your eyes, you can follow along.
This is easily. Reminding me, there's one sequence in particular, I don't want to go into spoilers, but yeah. Cuarón uses the depth of field really beautifully and in a powerful, heavy-hitting way, actually, to put you in the mind of a protagonist who is seeing something terrible yes. happening and has no, you know, your distance from it. You yes. want to look another over to it, but you can feel the distance from it.
Another one of the best scenes
brilliant,
in the film, yes.
Brilliant cinematographic
it's
choices.
Harrowing.
Harrowing, absolutely.
On the black and white, though, I agree with everything that's been said, but there are very few, I think, visual things that can transfix you in black and white, which are distinct and wholly far and above better than can be captured in color. That is the use of fire. And there is
a different
beautiful,
look.
Beautiful sequence with the use of fire in this film.
It's just a different look. I mean, Roma has a really distinctive look because of the black and white, I think.
I guess the only person who plays with depth of field and color from that perspective is Chalan, I guess, with that sort of Turkish lavish landscapes and doing that in color.
Yeah.
But still, no match for what's happening
yeah,
here.
Yeah, this is...
And I think that's part of my frustration is that...
This film looks really clean,
And capturing the scene in the water, oh my God. We talk about sound design, but how they capture that scene in and of itself.
Yeah. Oh man, it's just an incredible feat of cinematography. And
that's what I'm afraid of, that people are actually not going to realize what's hit them because it's on Netflix.
It's weird that it's on Netflix because, yeah, it doesn't fit the let's chill out and watch a Netflix movie.
No. Especially you run it lead up to Christmas. This is not a relaxing film.
Yeah, it's a heavy art film. And as we've spoken about, the photography is stunning and the sound design is amazing. It really feels like a film that's designed to be seen in a cinema, especially since there's barely any close-ups. The whole thing situates figures in these wide landscapes and the camera pans around as we watch them move around the scene.
Oh
and
God.
To appreciate that, right, a laptop is really not going to do the trick. This is 100% a film that needs and makes full use of the scale of the cinema screen for its visual impact.
Oh my God, I agree so much with you, Chris, especially because I think we've been overdosed with Hollywood cinema and those kind of, you know, super cuts back and forth.
Yep.
And this super sharp editing and close-ups.
I was having a conversation last week about how I think the visual language of film is changing because people are watching more stuff, you know, quickly on the go on a phone, and therefore more and more close-ups are dominating the visual approach of film, you know, because that's something that you can glean. You know, the main visual details of someone's face reacting to something, you can glean it on a phone size screen and not feel like you're missing out on it. I don't know what the emotional impact of this film would be on a phone screen. I just can't imagine it.
Cuarón's rejecting this, and I'm going to use one example. There is the sequence we haven't referred to at a lake where they're standing shooting game, and it's like watching the Night Watchman or these giant paintings in the New South Wales Art Gallery, because there is so much attention to detail.
So, such a painterly scene. You're right. The framing is so classical painting.
If it is on a phone or an iPad, I had the pleasure of watching this at a big screen. There's a couple opportunities to do so in Sydney. You should definitely
make use of it.
Do it.
But that's the thing, you know. If people don't watch it and their first experience of this is on a laptop, I don't know what that experience is going to be like. Like, if I were to now see this again on Netflix on a laptop.
Like I said, I can't even imagine.
I'm not sure how I'm going to feel about it. I'm so blessed and actually very thankful I saw it in the cinema, because that's one thing that I didn't realize I would feel like that until my first experience can actually tarnish or make or break a movie's relationship with it.
I think this is Cuarón's best film. I think people have to seek it out.
I think people should seek it out too. This is Roma. It is screening at the Cine Latino Film Festival on Saturday at the Verona and Sunday at Norton Street, and it will be on Netflix on December 14th, but please do catch it before. The next film we are talking about...
Unless you've got a 4K projector and a
massive
screen. Will Wong.
Yeah, Will Wong. You can wait till Netflix. Everyone else.
go see it at the movies. So the next film we are talking about is Suspiria, which is the remake of Dario Argento's classic cult film, which has been playing at festivals interminably for decades and decades. It is set in the 1970s in Berlin at the height...
And is it ever? God damn.
Yes. Oh, the Bader-Meinhof gang is here and just ever-present. Of course they are. Nothing signals 1970s Berlin like...
Berlin Wall.
David Bowie.
Bader-Meinhof.
And
blah, 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 blah.
What they're doing, literally checking it off a list or something, because that's what
it was very much like that. They did, like, they get the geography of the place right. Like, they went to Friedrichstrasse and Kreuzberg, and they went through there, and it was a very good recreation of what the images of what it did look like at the time. But yes, it is, you are in 1970s Berlin. they make this very, very clear. It is starring Dakota Johnson and Tilda Swinton in multiple roles, as we'll go on to discuss, Mia Goth and Chloe Grace Moretz, even though she's in it very sparingly. It is about, as is the original, a dance school and a young woman from the US who comes to the school which is a very painstaking procedure to, you know, get through these classes, but something strange is going on.
Witch.
Yes. So this is screening now. It got a big run, or a little bit of screening run in the lead up to Halloween.
Look, if you want to see it, I would go now, because this has been an absolute atomic bomb.
Talking about that, Atomic Blonde, another film set in Berlin. Cold War Germany.
Well, this is better than Atomic Blonde, thank God.
Really?
Yeah.
It's
much better. Blonde was like one of the most miserable experiences.
Not comparable, like the completely.
Yeah, except not comparable,
films.
Except for to say that Suspiria was much better, and Suspiria isn't even that good.
It's not a good film.
Suspiria is not a good film, but Atomic Blonde was offensively. Offensively pandering nonsense. Anyway,
before we talk about the remake, we have to talk about the original. We have to realize I watched the original for the first time recently, and it is not a classic because of the plot or anything that happens in the film. It is a classic because of the style, and somehow they keep up suspense for 98 minutes.
I'm glad you mentioned this, because this is a film where, for some reason. The 90-minute Suspiria, which, you know, barely sustains that. It holds up the suspense, but there is not much plot in 90 minutes of Suspiria.
And that was fine, because it worked as a pure impact.
Somehow has turned into this 170-minute monstrosity of tangled plot threads that barely relate to each other.
170 minutes?
It's tiring. I watched this last night. And
160 minutes, I think?
It's 160 minutes. It's 140.
No, it's longer than that.
Okay, maybe.
It's 100. Yeah, it actually is longer than that. Excuse me.
Longer.
It did feel very long. It goes on. But, a film this long cannot sustain suspense, simply.
But in extending this, they say, you know, okay, writer's meeting room. How are we going to extend Suspiria into a long movie for some reason? Because Luca Guadagnino wants to make an epic. Okay, it's set in, what's this? Germany in the 70s. We can run with that. So for some reason, there's this constant references to the political backdrop in Germany, which is so goddamn heavy-handed. Like, there's no reason that one of the characters in this has to, you know, be involved in Baader-Meinhof bombings. You know, there's no reason why the Holocaust needs to be tied into another character's backstory in the massively extensive way that it is.
That whole subplot was largely extraneous to the film.
All of these allusions to German history are at best tangentially related to the main goings-on in the plot. And so by forcing them so strongly onto this film, it feels complicated, plotting and heavy-handed. I think cutting all of that away and simply making a hyper-complex, intriguing story about political battles between witches set in the backdrop of 1970s Berlin is enough for an intelligent audience to start making their own connections to the politics of the time instead of trying to shove it down the audience's throat. It's a bad script.
It's a lousy script, and the entire subplot... One of my worst things about any film is when the main character changes mid-shift. If you follow, it's hard to track, but the older man, who is extraneous to almost all the action, somehow becomes the main character in this film. He has no reason to be front and center. He's not nearly as interesting as anything else going on. Sure, it's a great gimmick to have Tilda Swinton play both characters, but when they're required to be in the same room, it's jarring because you know they can't be in the same shot together. And it's distracting.
Well, I think there's a reason why he gradually becomes the main character, and I think it's tied to what ultimately sinks this film, which is all of the action of what's going on with Susie Banyan, Dakota Johnson's character, is withheld from the audience. There's some sort of mysterious plot going on with her, and it's completely a mystery until the climax. And when a character's entire motivations and even what they're doing at any point is unclear, it's hard to create an emotional connection. So therefore, they've gone, their focus switches to a subplot that is completely irrelevant to all, the entire witch narrative, which is really complex and easily enough to sustain a full feature film. It switches to the more easy human interest narrative going on there. But it, his, you know, Lutz Eberdorf, whatever, Joseph dude, old man Tilda Swinton, never... really, he gets dragged into the proceedings, but his story never intersects in a satisfying way.
No,
with
he's almost a
the
spectator.
Main
it's
yeah,
ridiculous.
he's a spectator.
But on the plot and what is happening in the background, the simple fact is the original film dealt, like this one, dealt with a lesser known philosophical and very theological element of what Suspiria is. It was very passingly dealt with in the original film, but that was fine because it wasn't the main point.
And because this, it's not a film that's about plot.
No.
But this is about plot in a huge way.
This is about plot, and this is one that relies on an investment and understanding of this mythos. The fact is, there are films, and they say in this, the little we actually learn, and we should have learned a lot more, is that these ideas predate Christian theology. Let's look at some films that are trying to be equivalent. The Wicker Man films, The Omen, where they're dealing with mythology, which is much more recognizable and even modern, but they deal with it, they explain it. Even The Omen, when it's all about 666 number of the Beast, Book of Revelations, they go into much more detail.
This doesn't go into
nearly as much detail, except we needed that, which makes the entire third act just unfathomable.
I would have been okay with a film that leaves the witchy stuff mysterious and, I guess, metaphorical, provided that, you know, you need something to latch
grounding.
Onto.
We did not get grounding in this film.
Yeah, just the grounding of the original, you know, Susie isn't as involved in the actual plot in the original Suspiria. And the grounding there is simply a woman is trying to figure out what's happening in this strange haunted house with hidden trapdoors everywhere. In this one, the grounding is, I'm not sure she knows what's going on and we don't. And so we watch this protracted build-up. It's long. It's really long. As Glenn said before we started recording, they could easily cut an hour, but it's not suspenseful. I was really hooked when this started because
the production... The train station where she drops the money oh, snap, okay. But then the suspense dropped after that.
Luca Guadagnino is a hell of a director. I think at times he actually pushes it too far. There's only so many times that you can watch showy directorial tricks of, you know, spinning cameras timed to weird music cues and strange sound design before it becomes a little bit overbearing. But he has great talent, as we've seen through all of his career up to date, and here he's really showing off. And that was working for me so much at first. I thought, here's an interesting world, realistically recreated 1970s Germany, which is a setting you don't usually get to see in cinema, with beautiful, beautiful production design and the sense that something big and mysterious is going on. I was hooked, but it just takes so long in getting to the point that I stopped caring.
And there's beautiful cinematography, which has to be acknowledged.
Look, I don't hate this movie. The cinematography is beautiful. The sets are incredible. I think there was definitely a really interesting film in there. The story is interesting. It's just that it's withheld from us for the whole time. And to focus on some political nonsense that is barely relevant.
I needed to get into it earlier. And the fact is, I think this is a film by someone who loves the original, but is trying to outdo it. And that is a problem.
It feels detached. It feels cold.
Strange.
Did you find that?
When it shouldn't be.
It shouldn't be with what's going on. Yeah.
It should be empathetic with all these characters.
Especially the climax seems to be working on this idea of that empathy is important and we need to move back to a place of empathy when we're at war with each other. I think that's what the film is meant to be about. But it doesn't work when you approach it in such a way that withholds the characters from us and stops the film's ability to build empathy.
We can barely, even with Mia Goth, who's in a great deal of film,
but
we don't get empathize with
there's
her.
There's some striking detail. Images in this, though. I admire that such
it's
a
beautiful crane shots and withheld and bat and shots.
Beautiful colors,
wide angle,
and interesting and sometimes ghastly horror imagery. I admire that such a weird directorial vision made it to the cinemas. I just wish it were better.
So that was Suspiria, which is in cinemas now. We have a few more thoughts on the podcast coming up as we will be talking about JFF, the Japanese Film Festival, which is screening until November 25th at Event Cinemas. We'll be talking about One Cut of the Dead, Killing,
and Night is Shot, Walk on Girl.
Roma, which you should absolutely catch, and is, unlike Suspiria, it's definitely not too long. We'll be screening at the Cinema
the right
Film
length.
Festival on Saturday and Sunday at Verona and Norton Street, respectively. We'll be on Netflix on December 14th.
It is long, but not too long. Get it right, Luca.
Oh my God, it was just so much.
Too much.
It was too much.
And too much is what we want to talk about in the podcast, which you should subscribe to.
Yes.
Not to say we won't talk about too much. We'll talk about how Suspiria is too much because we always talk just enough. Thank you very much.
Yes. So do subscribe on iTunes, Spotify. This has been Glenn Fung, Chris Evans, and Rotten Aru. Stay tuned for the podcast. Enjoy movies. Good night.
Witch.
Welcome to back to the Film Fight Club podcast. That is the incredible Tom York with the Suspiria soundtrack. Man, Tom York and Jodie Greenwood may be competing for best original score.
That's right. I think Phantom Thread is my favorite score I've heard this year from Jodie Greenwood. But
oh no, you were never really here. Absolutely.
Oh, that was that was incredible as well. They were both amazing. But yeah, Tom York.
Phantom Thread was this year, was it?
Yeah,
it was Australia. It's in all our Oscar movies always come in like February.
Yeah. It was February, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow. That feels like a while ago now.
Yeah, it does feel like 2 years ago almost.
Mm. So we're going to be talking more about JFF in a moment, but first we want to touch on a couple of things
about
Suspiria.
Yeah, well, on the subject of Tom York's music, man, right? It was so good.
Yeah, like really, with the production design, it was my favorite thing about the film.
Yeah, the sets, the cinematography is really nice as well. Some of the golden light seeping onto Tilda Swinton's face in these big close-ups.
She's really good. We have to give her
Tilda
credit.
Yeah, man. In the first time we really see Tilda Swinton showing off and she's strolling around the place, arching her back, you know, emitting huge puffs of smoke. She's just so goddamn cool.
Yeah, she's her.
She's always great.
The gif of her spinning around is actually a really like, oh, boom. She can scare. She doesn't need music cues. She doesn't need shocks. She doesn't need things coming out of the walls. She can just scare you because she's Tilda Swinton.
But I have to ask, why did Luca Guadagnino cast her as the old man?
It's like, why?
What was gained by that? Yeah, she was good, but why? It's such an expensive, it's like just because we can. It's such an expensive thing to do. Like old man actors got to work.
It's a good challenge for any actor or actress.
Yeah, I don't know. I just kind of feel like
it felt gimmicky, I think.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying.
I'm going to give her credit because by pure virtue of the fact that she was good and she fulfilled the role, I was happy with her being cast.
I guess I should give it that credit too because yes, she was good and she did fill the role. So, you know, artistic freedom in that, but it's like okay, it's much better than. But remember Guy Pearce playing the old dude in Prometheus?
Oh, that was the whole movie was bad.
Or another
run to the side, just run to the side.
Well, we were spared another Ridley Scott old man gimmick with Kevin Spacey and All the Money in the World.
See, that was a good. So I just got back to Prometheus. That was a good twist. I've got to say, the fact that he was on the ship. But still might one day see that version.
But
don't discount it.
Look, Tilda Swinton was good, but I think there's a gravitas to seeing an actual real person that I think you're missing in the Tilda Swinton performance. I think it's really good, but imagine how different this would feel if, for example, Christopher Plummer was playing this role in Suspiria.
Hello, Ian McKellen.
Yeah, Ian McKellen. Like, there's something. There's
someone
I think,
who can connote age and being weathered.
That's
which
right.
She could not do as well.
She's trying to, but it's always going to be, you know, imitation. And I think there's a power in a close up of a real old man expressing a lot of longing and regret, which is what this character is all about.
Think of the Plummer in Beginners.
Exactly.
A really underrated film.
Exactly.
So a couple more things with Suspiria. On the violence in this film, which is very distinct from the original film. The original film was so hyper-stylized, and it worked because there were these outlandish, ridiculous things happening, and it was as affecting. In this, the violence, particularly one sequence in a dance studio in the first act, is incredibly brutal.
Oh,
it doesn't
man.
Actually mesh with the hyper-realist stuff that is happening elsewhere. Yeah. It's just we've just decided, oh, we're going to have these incredibly graphic sequences with these absurd other goings on.
Yeah, it's quite strange. You mean the absurd other goings on being the witch blood?
That and the otherwise, yeah, but essentially, yes. I mean, the original was so saturated with the color, the depiction of violence in that film worked. Here, it's much more muted, and you feel it much more, which is, I don't think, what the Guadagnino was actually going for, but that's the effect.
I mean, this film is still extremely stylized, but it's a different kind of stylization.
Yeah,
as we were saying, the colors are very muted, and this one's really, like, camera flying around a million different strange angles, trying to create a weird atmosphere, and really intricate production design, creating this browny, weathered-looking environment. It definitely feels like something scary is about to happen whenever you're down those holes.
Speaking of something scary about to happen, for the next few minutes, should we have our spoiler discussion of the ending of Suspiria?
Yeah, let's go there, and let's also talk about the violence in the early scene you were talking about.
Okay, so for the next, let's say, 3 to 4, 5 minutes, we're going to be doing Suspiria, spoilers, spoiler alert, and then we'll be getting into all things JFF. Okay, so the ending, wow, that was nuts. That was just
completely ridiculous.
Out of nowhere. It was just a different film entirely. What essentially happens is the Dakota Johnson character, who actually is good in this film, we have to give her credit, has a enormous character arc in the space of a few minutes and becomes
That's the thing. This huge character arc has been going on that has been outside of our understanding, that she's apparently, you know, is, and we don't find out until very close to the end of the film that she's knowingly been part of this witch plot. And I mean, I'm still not even completely sure. It's all very obscure, but we know that she's telekinetically communicating with Tilda Swinton and seems to be aware of her place to some degree.
And speaking of which, and this is implied to go all the way back to her life in Amish country, which, and I don't know about you, but all these flashbacks to her living in rural Pennsylvania, I didn't find those scariest. But maybe it's because I've spent time there, I have family there, but it's not really, it wasn't spooky at all. It was just
regular
and
I liked
uneventful.
The frame turning red in those shots.
Okay, that was nice. That was straight out of the first film. That was straight out of the original.
Was it?
There were moments where
The really searing colors, yeah. But Luca Guadagnino has some interesting lo-fi effects going on here, like tilting, you know, tinting the frame red or purple to connote something scary is going to happen, or shooting with like the really slow shutter speed, people blurring between the shots to connote magic is in the air.
I did appreciate that. But then the ending, just the giant cult sequence of crazy dancing, and it felt closer to, you know what it felt like? It felt not too dissimilar from the end of Blade, and that's not what they should have been going for.
Yeah. It's not scary.
It's not scary.
Man, but you just mentioning the flashbacks to the Amish country just reminds me of how clunky this film is. There's so much in this film that doesn't tie together very well, so it just feels like it's jutting out in all different directions, much like Olga in her dance torture sequence.
My God, that was... And the same with the Mia Goth sequence later in the film. It was just so graphically violent. Didn't leave it up to suggestion, which I think worked in the original.
I mean, the original still is fairly, by the standards of when it came out, it was very sensationally
graphically
violent.
It was omen violent.
Right. Yeah, it was, it's over the top. This, yeah, there's a sequence where Olga, a dancer who accuses the witches of being witches.
Yeah. Look, if there's just, which starts, yeah, careful, maybe.
Yeah. As Dakota Johnson dances, she is in another room magically linked to Dakota Johnson's dance movements. So her body gets ripped in several directions. There's lots of bones breaking. And she's like spitting and urinating and vomiting and writhing, foaming at the mouth. And the sound design is just nasty. I was kind of like wincing from the screen, but it had no effect because the sound of the bones shattering is just there.
Yeah, it would have been, I think, more impactful if the use of the Hall of Mirrors, which she was in,
oh yeah,
was very
fantastic.
Good.
I think it
could have relied on that aesthetic much more.
It's strange though to put such a ferociously violent scene quite front and center in this film and then not go down kind of more dark and violent directions.
There isn't anything else like, or there is one sequence where Mia Goth's character discovers Bones that character.
Yeah.
Otherwise, no, there's nothing like it. Even the final sequence where Tilda Swinton, what happens to Tilda Swinton's character isn't nearly as violent. And then it becomes mellow at the end of the film.
It's a kind of violence that we're prepared for. Exploding heads and blood spraying everywhere is usual, you know, the usual for supernatural horror. Seeing somebody, you know, folding, essentially fold, you know, bent over backwards and folded their arms and legs, you know, going ways that they shouldn't is something new. I mean, props for a new terrifying horror sequence. I can't say it's something I've ever seen before. I
didn't find it particularly terrifying at all.
It's not terrifying, but it's gross.
It's
definitely gross.
I don't think that's what he was going for. I don't think that was the main reaction he was pursuing.
Yeah, this film doesn't seem like it's pursuing the gross response.
Yeah.
This is such a high-minded art film.
Yes.
I'll give some more credit here. I could say what I said about that sequence for the film as a whole. I have never seen anything like it. It's a weird film. It didn't work, but I think there was potential for this to work really well. The idea of a war between witches, you know, which is a witch who is controlling people to prolong a regime about senseless violence and somebody trying to create change from within is an interesting concept. But the film is too busy trying to keep it a secret from us until the ending for us to really get involved in the political intrigue. But I loved the early scene where we see the witches voting and they're all hanging out in a big 70s kitchen and dining room. I thought, this is such a new take on witches, you know, just seeing them just hanging out in the environment.
And what I did
and the politics
after the head explosion scene was just, there was just a regular scene of someone cleaning it up because someone has to clean it
up.
Oh,
yeah, yeah.
It was great.
There's a hilarious cut between, you know, Tilda Swinton, what was her character's name? Madame Blanc has left the company. Cut to suddenly.
So just like mopping casually. Of course, some gopher has to do this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's such a mess, right? They're like, we're all of a sudden, we go from this sort of subtle, restrained. Okay, it might sound ridiculous to call this movie subtle and restrained because the direction
the
is always so
isn't.
Over
be.
The top, but it's not so much restrained as it is slow. We go from, you know, slow and not much is happening to suddenly heads are exploding, the walls are being painted red, and Luca Guadagnino is making the frame flash red.
For anyone who saw Call Me By Your Name and loved it, as we did, this is the exact opposite of this film.
Yeah.
I'd rather see Call Me By Your Name again.
But there's some similarities in how he frames
shots. Not everyone loves Call Me By Your Name.
Maybe you'd love Suspiria if you watched it. You could be the odd one out.
No.
But maybe. You never know.
You never know.
Never know if you never, never go.
So that is Suspiria. It's in cinemas now. Let's talk JFF. Let's talk One Cut of the Dead, which is we talked about last week with the festival director, Alison Groves, and it's a pretty cool idea. I haven't seen it yet. I'm waiting for this weekend because I want to see it with a crowd. But the idea of a low-budget film and a 37-minute one-take of a zombie mayhem ensuing to more zombie mayhem later in the film sounds like a pretty sweet flick.
Well, the best way to watch this film would be not knowing anything about it except that it opens with a long one-take zombie scene.
Because that's not the sell of the film, actually. And like film is not even about that. So actually, in a way, it's interesting.
So
that's,
if anything,
the sell.
I'll say this is the spoiler discussion of One Cut of the Dead.
Okay, so we're having a spoiler discussion?
Not really. It's just I would not have liked knowing the kind of stuff you have to discuss in order to review this properly.
Yeah.
Right.
So this film is satirizing, like, so many things, and it's difficult to talk about without spoiling
let's just mood of the film. Get into it. Maybe Glenn can cover his ears, and I'll give him a signal. Yeah, I know you want to see this film, unless you're...
Are we having a spoiler discussion, or...?
Okay. It's not... I guess we are, yeah.
Okay.
No, then
if we want to talk about the movie,
let him
you have
it.
To.
Right. Okay, well, I'll be here. I'll listen. It's all good, but we are having a spoiler discussion of One Cut of the Dead.
You sure, man?
We have been warned. Let's do it.
All right. Well, the opening shot... It's a really fun, well-directed, with strange, interesting moments, one-shot zombie thing. It's people are making a movie about zombies when suddenly and we're watching them making a movie about zombies in one take when suddenly zombies attack. And the director seems to be embracing the mayhem and thrusting his cast into dangerous scenarios.
You know, just
that sounds incredible.
Just imagine those directors or those already people who are like, I'm willing to go to any length for to get my perfect shot.
Right.
This is that director. But
you know, with no consideration for anyone's safety. Unlike any real directors, anyway.
Who are they? Where can I find them?
The big reveal. Okay, the movie slows down for me after this one shot. We go back 1 month and suddenly...
Should I step out of the studio now?
Do you want to...
Should I?
Well, yeah, if you want to just freshly...
I'm gonna step out for just 1 minute and then point back because I'm really...
Yeah, this is what I was trying to tell you before.
Cool. Wait, 1 sec. Glenn will be right back.
All right, and if you want to see this movie and you've got a shot, just, you know, listen in to a minute from now. Okay, so after that... It's revealed that this is a film about the making of that one shot, which is such a clever idea because one shots, I think, are by their nature about the making of themselves. One shots draw attention, you know, one shots are always billed as like a more immersive experience that puts you there, but they're really not. What they actually do is make you aware of the fact that, oh, movies usually have cuts. This doesn't have a cut. Oh, there's a camera still rolling, so that you become aware of the camera and you start to think about the procedure involved and the choreography and mechanics of making that one shot. So here they've decided to make a comedy about
filmmaking, essentially.
Yeah, you witnessing all the weird moments that you saw in that first one shot are explained in the second half of the film as we see recreated those strange moments in the one shot.
In a way, it's a Rashomon film, but about filmmaking, essentially. You know, you see the same thing happen. But
there are definitely some that I thought of the film Bowfinger in the way that we look at the magic of people using low resources, improvising and throwing things together in order to make movie magic happen.
Very Kino Cabaret kind of feel to it.
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is. But in a very good way. Like, you know, you can see how when people at their sort of, you know, resources end, and they have to actually come with ingenious ideas to just...
And it works out.
Yeah, things happen.
Yeah, it's funny and joyous seeing the complicated sequence we watched at the beginning of the film.
But also, like, genuinely clever. Because
the teamwork involved
is something with...
is great to behold.
What Agnino and Suspiria, which is trying to be clever, but this is just actually clever.
Yeah, there was a lot of genuine... Oh, man, that movie's just plodding. This is filled with genuine wit. I think the worst point of the film is the setup, explaining how the film came together after the end of the one shot. But then witnessing the one shot created is just so much fun. I'm going to invite Glenn back into the studio now. We recommend One Cut of the Dead.
Yes, because then once you realize the actual title and what it means once you see the movie.
Yeah, it's great.
Well, I was absent for that. I hope there was no slanderous importations regarding Glenn.
I will say that the title, One Shot of the Dead, would be more how you'd translate it over here, because in Japan they understand that one cut means it's in one shot, but in over here, yeah, that's what it means.
So that was One Cut of the Dead, which I'm very, very excited to see. The next one we're talking about is, are we doing Killing next?
Yeah, Killing's a strange one.
Yeah, where do we begin with this one?
I'll be seeing this one too, so I'm quite excited to see it with the studio audience.
Okay.
So studio audience.
Why did you come back in? Just stay out there. Glenn.
Live with our studio audience. No, Killing, it's directed by Shinya Tsukamoto, known for low budget violence. And here he continues the trend. This one's jarringly low budget at first, I thought. You can tell that this was shot so quickly. Like, often the frame's a little awkward. Like, it's like they've shot it so quickly they haven't even really had time to steady the camera. And you can see that in order to speed things up, often they're just cropping in on the same shot rather than get two shots.
Yeah, I mean...
Oh no.
I mean, low budget. Let's shoot in 4K and release it in 2K so we can zoom in at random points.
Right.
It feels lazy, but at the same time, the actual... Like, the mechanics of how the film works is really clever. So, like...
It's a strange... Yeah, it's definitely different.
It made me feel like the technicality of movie making was lacking.
Well,
but that's deliberate, I guess, if that's his style.
That is his style.
So he's not going for that. What he's going for, like, is actual experience.
I thought the filmmaking was actually quite creative in a way that maybe if this film was made with a bigger budget, it wouldn't be. The action sequences, as is his style, are so, you know, frenetic. Really, you know, the camera's veering all over the place and it's tilting and there's fast cuts. It is this very digital contemporary aesthetic, which is applied to a, you know, realistic period samurai drama. And it's a jarring but fascinating effect for me. I think this film probably would not have been as interesting if it had a higher budget. And they, you know, instead of getting creative in the way that they had chosen to shoot it, had just gone the usual way. The violence is really dynamic, and it really pierces through in the way this is shot. And the action scenes are really interesting to watch.
And that's something I think which has been a recurring theme in the films I've seen at GFF this year, at least. It's how the lack of resources of having low budget is actually no bar to being creative.
Yeah, that's right. There's a lot of creativity going on.
And actually,
there,
They become better for it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there's some creative ways of doing it, which, you, like Chris mentioned, you otherwise wouldn't be able to do if you had more money. Then you probably wouldn't even be thinking like that, because your brain wouldn't be working in that kind of direction. Because
Its creativity is problem solving, you know?
It's fun.
There's some interesting problem solving going on here. I didn't really empathize much with the characters, but I still found this an interesting, at least on paper, it's a interesting character dynamic. It's really about this older samurai and younger samurai in training. And sort of like a junior samurai. I don't know enough about samurai.
Yeah, that's the thing.
In order to comment
on this. I was thinking
this.
Zorro, essentially, right? But it's not that.
But yeah, he turns out not to be as honorable a person as he bills himself to be, and ends up creating a lot of problems for the protagonist. And the town he's from, the farmers that he's serving. It's really a film that's interrogating the idea of honorable samurai and suggesting that they really lord themselves over people they have not much consideration for, and are dishonorable are free to abuse their power and be dishonorable in the way that they choose to kill. Like I said, I didn't fully engage with the drama. I found it a little bit too thin, and it's a short film. It's only about 78 minutes, and it could have gone a lot longer and developed the drama more, but still interesting.
Should we talk about our favorite movie after the three?
You know, actually, my favorite was One Cut of the Dead, which might surprise you.
Whoa. Yeah. Okay. It did surprise me.
I'm a big fan of Masaaki Yuasa, but Night is Short, Walk on Girl is not my favorite I've seen from him, but still impressive as always. What did you think, Farhad?
I really like his work, and I've been recently introduced to his work thanks to Chris. So, you know, one more thing I have to thank Chris for, which is seemingly weird now that we're becoming like best
friends. Fight Club.
No, I seem to be fighting you more often than I'm fighting Chris these days. I don't know why that is, because you just drifted, Glenn. You've just...
I've changed.
You're not the same.
I've changed. Maybe you should watch a series, then we can fight about it.
Ah, well, yeah, but maybe I might like it then. It might be a good fight. But yes, it's funny in the sense, firstly, like, it's very nostalgic. It's probably from a very personal point of view. I was a philosophy major. I've done all the stupid things that everyone...
Did you like The Sophists?
Yes.
In this film?
I know those people. Like, you know...
Yeah.
Sydney University, you know, Manning Bar, Herman's, you know, whatever.
Yep. That's where my West Wing trivia nights were. There was so much fun.
Student politics and these sort of philosophy drama groups and,
yeah.
And
I'm a little indie,
romantic societies.
This film
is essentially about a woman called the Black-Haired Girl, who's, I guess she's on a pub crawl.
Yeah.
She's going through Kyoto and drinking, and a boy who has a crush on her is also traveling.
And he's on a mission.
Kyoto,
it's
drinking.
Called Appear Before Her Often.
Yeah, his mission is to appear before her so often in different times and places that she believes that it must be fate bringing them together.
Oh, that's not freaky at all. That's not.
But
don't do this.
But the thing is, like, the way it's introduced, it's so over the top.
It's so
hilarious.
It's,
I've seen, like, philosophy students do this. So, like, also, right. Sorry.
Yeah, they're all college students. And there's stories involving the intrigue of different political clubs, different clubs at the university.
For this movie captures something.
It does capture something
unique
of it,
and genuine about the university experience, which a lot of movies just do not get. I see a lot of directors trying to make movies about young people and fail miserably because they just do not get young people.
Hmm.
This movie actually does get young people quite well. It's not afraid of being juvenile and stupid, and yet not judging them for it.
I think compared to some, maybe the best work I've seen from Masaki Yuasa, this one's... it's hard to criticize. I was going to say that it's a little bit, you know, too silly to really have a huge emotional impact, but silliness is really the name of the game. I just maybe found it a little bit too tilted on the side of loose sketches, because there is a cohesive theme that's meant to be tying it all together, which becomes clear towards the end. But I think that could have been stronger. That could have been stronger articulated through the film if the characters and their connections to each other had been more of a focus throughout. But nonetheless, it's really amusing. And his art as an animator is getting ridiculously developed at this point. There's this sequence near the end of this, which is just... which is a dream sequence, which is so
energy.
Frenetic and just full of ideas and strange strange juxtapositions, large-scale action. It just keeps going and going and going. And this guy's imagination is on another level.
And he can actually blend four or five different worlds in, and they can sort of self-combust into each other.
Like a dream works.
Way
that he captures the way that dreams work in that way. And the world of this film is... simultaneously feels like flat and completely unreal, and yet somewhere that you feel you could go and visit. The colors are eye-popping.
It's an amazingly for a visual thing, and that's probably good animation.
I really liked the ending. The black-haired girl is a very thin sort of, you know, she can do anything, and she doesn't have much of a motivation. I want to explore the sites, but I get he's. This film is really more like sketch comedy and about the individual moments than it is about fully fleshed out characters. But I still,
but at the same
I guess
time,
maybe would have liked a little bit more
making,
from her.
Making a bit deeper point about that, like, you know, that he doesn't give her any kind of agency to exist.
Yes, they do. They do make that point later on.
So it is kind of self-aware, and in that way, I wanted to criticize it, but I'm like,
they're not super sympathetic characters.
What it's doing, yeah.
It's really going into that kind of. Silly zone where actual empathy with the characters might detract from what he's going for. It's just full on nonsense where characters can get punched into the distance and, you know, the laws of physics can switch out. It's a good time.
It's a fun movie and
it's definitely fun and it's definitely very creative and much more interesting than any animation that has been happening in the West of late.
How does it compare to In This Corner of the World, which we reviewed earlier this year, which is also screening at the festival?
Yeah, I preferred it to In This Corner of the World, actually. But it's much, much less of an emotional kick than that film. But actually, the ending of this film was really nice. Did you find that too? that surprised me when suddenly it hit me.
That's constant throughout all its works.
Yeah.
There's something about it doesn't matter if he loses the plot midway through. He's able to bring things together in a way that you did not expect. And that's part of the charm because you don't even think he's going for a deeper point.
And then suddenly it hits you.
And actually
I do think that deeper point could have been more tied into the film. And some of his better works, like Mind Game, when the reveal of this is what it's all about happens at the end, it felt more cohesive. And that's another film which is very loose and sketchy. But so I don't think this is the best thing he's ever done. But definitely worth checking out. And
still
a good introduction.
Head and shoulders above anything that's out there at the moment. Yeah.
Yeah, he's definitely one of the most interesting animation directors working consistently right now in the world, if not the most interesting. This year, he's already put out a great series on Netflix called Devilman Crybaby. Yes, I know. which is worth checking out as well. Much darker, but the same kind of kinetic and creative madness going on.
I mean, who doesn't want to get to know Philosophy Dude Bros, honestly?
Me.
All right, Glenn.
Because I just finished watching Good Place Season 3. So.
Well, what about, would you be perhaps interested in our other offer, which is the Guerrilla Theater Group, who put on, they're running from the student group police while putting on impromptu theater performances, which are about the actions of the student group police department.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah. Well, that is one of the many wonders that you can experience in Night is Short, comma, Walk on Girl, screening now at JFF. Yeah,
this film is actually bonkers. Like,
it's
in a really good way.
Yeah.
So that is JFF. It is screening at Event Cinemas George Street from now, from the 15th of November until the 25th of November.
So you'll have like a couple of days.
Yeah. One Cut of the Dead is screening on Saturday night, and Killing is screening on Saturday night as well. They're a double. So yeah, that's all things JFF. Roma is at Cine Latino. You should definitely check it out. And we'll be back next week talking about...
Suspiria doesn't even get mentioned again.
And Suspiria, it will always be playing interminably in the back of our minds, just haunting us.
Oh God, why did I watch it then?
Yeah.
I didn't sign up for this. It's not that bad. It's just frustrating. It's one of those
original.
Films I like. Yeah, watch the original.
Watch the original and watch these other better films like Call Me By Your Name.
This is an interesting experiment. It's an interesting world that it's depicting. I still would recommend you check it out if anything about it sounds interesting to you. It's just easy to complain about it because it's so frustrating.
They need an hour. Cut an hour.
Cut an hour, yeah.
I'm usually
cut
not
the politics.
I'm usually not an advocate for cutting, you know, a film. Like, let it go.
I should be clear. Cut the real world politics. Keep the witch world politics.
That was much more interesting.
Much more
We don't know the film about the Better Meinhof gang.
No.
No, we don't at all.
I mean, why was, Chloe Grace Moretz at the beginning?
She was barely in this
Why the hell was she doing RAF bombings? Well, what was the point of that?
We were given no context. I mean, the Better Meinhof gang isn't a particularly... Again, this is another thing. We needed some context for who this group was. I mean, it's a relatively ubiquitous name. Most people aren't familiar with their history. We needed that grounding, again, as we did with the history of the
I mean, they
the
were
coven.
Respecting the audience's intelligence to know about it. But I think even knowing the background there, it's such a tenuous link and just heavy-handed to push it when... The political intrigue going on among the witches is enough.
It's so much more interesting.
Anyway, I'm breaking my rule that we would talk just enough and not too much. So, that was Suspiria.
We're back next week with Widows and Anna in the Apocalypse. It's not one of the best films of the year. And one thing you should check out also Friday night, the Irish Film Festival, which is going to its fifth year, are having their first pop-up screening ever, Black 47. The Australian premiere is happening Friday night at the Chevelle Cinema, and then a screening is subsequently happening in Melbourne too. I'm looking forward to it, so please do come check it out. It'll be a fun night. So this has been Glenn Falkenstein, Chris Evans, and Virat Nehru. Have a wonderful night. Enjoy movies.
Love witches.
Love witches. Love sandwiches. Good night.
Good night.